Welcome to Background Briefing. This is Graham Fitzgibbon, producer of Background Briefing. With the unfortunate news that Ian Masters is feeling a bit under the weather today, though it's a rare occurrence for Ian to miss a beat and sit a program out, this time we thought it a good opportunity to revisit a few recent discussions we feel worthy of more attention. We'll begin today with Ian's interview on the 17th anniversary of 9/11 with former Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who with historical nuance explains shifting coalitions in the Middle East and the apparent effort on the part of Israel and Saudi Arabia to drag the U.S. into a confrontation with Iran, a scenario Republicans could cynically use as a distraction against the threat of impeachment and defeat in the midterms. Please note that Ian Masters will be back live tomorrow at 5 p.m. Here's Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
And joining us now is Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. And currently he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Wilkerson.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you. And if you were in the White House, in the Trump White House today, would you have written that anonymous op-ed?
I would have resigned and perhaps then written it. I certainly wouldn't have written it and remained a member of the administration.
And what's your sense then of where this is heading? Because much of the press obsession is about who wrote it rather than what it said, and of course it's gotten under Trump's skin, and he's obviously very thin-skinned.
That's no question. And probably one of the most thin-skinned people in such a position of power that I've ever encountered. I think you're right about not concentrating on what it said as opposed to the fact that it actually was published. Is a real problem, but that problem spans the gamut, particularly here in the East. I'm sure it's probably the same in the West. I find it all across the Middle West and the South that people aren't paying attention to what is happening. Part of it's because they've got jobs, they've got concerns, they've got children, college is going to be a home mortgage for them or worse and so forth. But still, there is such an apathy in this country, it is stunning that we even have a modicum, if that, of a democracy left. I listened to an NPR special. They're doing a series now on and interviewing Americans on why some 60% of them never vote. Listening to these people talk is like listening to a lost cause, a lost country. They do not believe that voting means anything, and right now it can mean everything, the entire future, in terms of such existential challenges as climate change, which is roaring at us like a freight train down the track, and foreign relations, which are falling apart even as I speak, and people aren't voting. There is a distinct difference between what is in Washington now and what could be in Washington were people to take interest and concern and go vote.
Well, it is a perennial puzzlement to me because, for example, I come from Australia where it's compulsory to vote. You get a fine, like a parking ticket. And it results in the fact that over 90% of people vote regularly. And that translates in terms of social democracy because your politicians basically are servants of the people and their job is to be stewards of the taxpayers' money and provide services. Whereas here, our politicians have been turned into telemarketers. They spend their entire days dialing for dollars and only a few hours a day doing the people's business.
Precisely. And those dollars increasingly come from things like the Koch Institute and the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, other billionaires, and corporate interests, big food, big oil, big pharmacy, and so on, that have none of the people's interest at heart, and their special interests are paramount.
Well, you mentioned Sheldon Adelson. Of course, he is, I think, either the biggest funder of Trump or the second biggest after Mercer. And he clearly has a clout because I think in Trump world, money talks. And Trump, of course, is a phony billionaire, whereas Adelson is a multi-billionaire. And Adelson is, from my understanding, he's the guy that foisted John Bolton on us. And it looks as though, and you wrote a recent article, the neoconservative comeback, it looks as if the neocons are coming back. Is that because of the vacuum at the top?
I think that's part of it. You may have seen a counter article to mine written by a friend of mine. He and I talked about it. I welcomed his article. He said, no, they're not staging a comeback. They never left. To a certain extent, he's right. You had people like Brian Hook, who's now running Iran policy for Mike Pompeo and negating even the kind of Tillerson effect Pompeo might have had, because Brian Hook is a former employee of John Bolton, a former assistant to him. Brian Hook and the Iran group have one purpose in life, and that is to increase sanctions weight on Iran until the regime collapses. That's their purpose. And Bolton's purpose, if that fails, is to get Trump to declare a war against Iran, probably through Syria, which we're seeing right now with these just lurid suggestions of false flag operations, accusing Assad of stockpiling chlorine gas. He's going to use the gas. And then they're going to turn to Trump. Bolton's going to turn to Trump, and he's going to say, well, you said he shouldn't do it, and he did it. Now what are you going to do? Then there's a possibility of a standoff between Mattis and Bolton, because Mattis is probably not going to want to do what Bolton wants to do in terms of the level of force that's used. This is a real recipe for more war, more immersion in the Middle East, and more disaster. We're looking at a $29 to $30 trillion deficit by the Congressional Budget Office, the GA, you look at whomever you look at in the next 10 to 15 years. This is unsustainable. The empire is going to break apart, and Trump is going to be the initiator of that breakup, or even is right now such an initiator.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. And currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Well, unfortunately, my understanding is that Mattis is on his way out because of the quotes in the Woodward book, the sort of weight of them has really gotten to Trump. And one of the quotes in the Woodward book is from Mattis, I believe, or he's likely the source, where Trump just had a fit over the alleged use of gas by Assad in, I think it was in Douma, and Trump went ballistic and was cursing and saying, I want to kill this SOB, I want to kill all of them. And, of course, Mattis walked back that order. That's what you're dealing with here. So Bolton and his deputy, now in charge of Iran policy, they've also been on the payroll of the MEK, as has Rudolph Giuliani. So what?
Yeah, Giuliani's getting ready to take another big tranche of cash, apparently, as he addresses them, I think, in New York City.
Right.
I have some problem with what Bob Woodward writes, because I have been in the room with the principals whom Bob Woodward later quotes in his books, and I've known that those principals did not say what Bob says they said. That's not a question of Bob's fidelity. What Bob does is trade access to the 800-pound gorillas for the truth. Most people, including my old boss, Colin Powell, tell things afterwards. They're quite a bit different from what they said in the actual circumstances, because, like all humans, they're spinning the story to make themselves look well. So I wouldn't put a lot of weight on what Bob Woodward's instant history depicts. I would say, though, that, as I just indicated, if Bolton wants major military action against Assad, and I'm talking about heavy, heavy action, not just cruise missiles, and Mattis disagrees, and as you just indicated, that might bring it to the head, and Mattis walks out, then we have lost, I think, the last sane national security member of the administration. And I fear for what we might do post that loss.
But isn't this all being driven by Netanyahu and MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, and his mentor, MBZ, in the Emirates?
A lot of it is, and they have a direct pipeline into the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in the UNE, into different organizations in Washington. They have people who are spokespersons for them from those organizations. They have people who, as Powell and I used to discuss from time to time about Douglas Feith, are probably card-carrying members of the Likud party. They care more about Israel and Israel's interest in the sense of greater Zionism than they do the U.S. interest. And will sacrifice readily U.S. interest to those Israeli interests. And that's back with a vengeance right now, particularly with FDD.
Well, we saw that yesterday with the closure of the Palestinian mission and the attack on the International Criminal Court. Samantha Ravitch, she comes from the Foundation of for Defense of Democracies, right? She's now the chairman of the Intelligence Advisory Board.
She's the deputy.
Right, deputy, right. Sorry. Yeah.
She was in Cheney's office, responsible for, among other things, areas that went to hell in a handbag during that time. Putting Samantha Ravitch as deputy of the advisory board is like saying, I want tainted intelligence. Please give me tainted intelligence.
Well, I find it really obscene, the idea that Netanyahu and MBS, who I think is really disgraceful, and the idea that he's pulled off this public relations move that cast himself as a reformer, and he's got people like Tom Friedman saying that this guy is a reformer when it's so clear that he's the opposite.
You know, it's all cosmetic, the women driving, that sort of thing. It's all cosmetic. Underneath, he is probably a most conservative member of a most conservative group of Arabs. And I would put that to the point that if we think there were members of the Saudi government, and I certainly do think there were members of the Saudi government who were complicit in 9/11 and the attacks thereon, then Mohammed bin Salman is of that family. And so I have no use for the individual. Saudi Arabia is the greatest state sponsor of terrorism in the world.
Well, but the king, who apparently has Alzheimer's, the father of MBS, he governed the region where almost all of the 9/11, 15 of the 19 were Saudis. So that's a fairly obvious connection.
I'm convinced that there were now, it took a long time to convince me of this, but I've seen the data, I've seen the archives, I've seen the record, at least parts of it, that are revealing. And there is no doubt in my mind now that there were, in fact, members of the Saudi royal family and government who knew what was happening in California, for example, and were supporting it in terms of the terrorists who were there.
Well, that whole story is so riven with coincidences that the Saudi consulate out here in Los Angeles happened to be at the same restaurant as two of the of the 9/11 hijackers and overheard their conversation. And his job was to keep an eye on young Saudi students over here to make sure that
thousands of dollars happened to make their way into their hands just coincidentally.
Right, and the wife of the Saudi ambassador in Washington, her money ended up in their hands as well. So, you know, Bob Graham, I've spoken to him at length, former chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, he tried to do everything he could, but for some reason or other, that story has never really come out, has it?
It never has, and I know Graham is frustrated about that. I've talked with him about it. Others are, too. It reminds us a lot of the commission that was put together and more or less orchestrated by Alan Dulles, whom JFK had fired as director of the CIA, to look into the assassination of JFK. There's no doubt in my mind that that commission, like the 9/11 commission, whitewashed a lot of its results and did so with the knowing complicity of certain members of the government.
So on this anniversary of 9/11, we were just minutes ago talking about Saudi Arabia and Israel's Netanyahu pushing the United States into a war with Iran. And Iran, of course, is under economic pressure at the moment. Things are it's sort of ripe for revolution, but the last thing you'd want to do is have a foreign power invade. Then, of course, the Iranians will rally around the flag because they're patriots. It's crazy, the idea of doing it. But do you think that somehow you can get the message out to the American people that our boys and girls shouldn't die in yet another war in the Middle East to satisfy a couple of Middle Eastern leaders?
I hope I'm right about this. I think just as with President Obama's administration, when he was contemplating and John Kerry was pushing for major ground forces in Syria, that the American people are war weary to the point right now and weary of the cost of those wars, both in blood and treasure, that Donald Trump might find there's more than 60% of America rises up in objection to any major effort he might make in Syria or Iran. And I hope that doesn't produce a constitutional crisis, because when that happens, a majority of the Congress, even Republicans, has to sort of take note of that, particularly with the midterms coming up. So people are telling me, well, he'll start a war. He'll start a war in order to increase the chance Republicans can hold on to both houses of Congress. And I've said, be careful what you wish for, though, if you're Donald Trump, because that might be the exact opposite impact of his starting a war, is they might throw the bastards out immediately. And I'm not asking for a war to make that happen, but I'm saying that you got to be very careful with these domestic politics. I think the American people, 60% of them at least, cards and letters, emails, constituent visits, and everything poured into Washington with regard to Obama's contemplation of putting ground forces in Syria. I think that would happen again. I hope it would anyway. And that might be a showstopper for this moron who's taken the White House.
Well, but the Iraq War, for example, the very beginning was, you know, they even had theme songs written for CNN. It was widely celebrated, and it was a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. But it took a while for the slow defeat to catch on. So, you know, a few days before or a week or so before the elections, my sense is that that war euphoria might drown out the voices that you're talking about. Or do you think that people are sufficiently soured that they're not going to be conned another time?
I've been in almost every state in the last 5 to 6 years, and I have talked to audiences of every age and demographic and different wealth considerations, rich people, middle-class people, poor people, and I find the most dominant thought out there with regard to foreign policy and security policy is we've been at war far too long, 17, 18 years now. And we need to stop this. And this goes across the political spectrum, independent, Democrat, Republican, Green Party, whatever. I gave a talk at the Ron Paul Institute a couple of weeks ago, and I was stunned by the unanimity of the different people who listened to my speech on YouTube or whatever. I mean, liberals, libertarians, Tea Party, Republicans, Democrats, independents from all over the country sent me emails and said, you're absolutely right. This is idiotic. This is stupid. This is ruining us, our treasury, everything. It's ruining us. And this is without a draft. This is without what the Vietnam War caused through the draft to be a real issue, because no one has any skin in the game today. Less than 1% of America's sons and daughters serve in the armed forces. Nonetheless, Americans are getting sick and tired of this constant war.
But how can we have a $716 billion defense budget and not have any real enemies?
Well, a lot of Americans don't complain about the amount of the defense budget because they think that is what prevents wars. What I've been trying to do in many of my talks is educate them to the point that, no, that is what creates wars, because when you build this tool, you must use it. And the military-industrial complex, and it's not that anymore. Eisenhower would be appalled at what it is today. It's the military-industrial, congressional, university, think tank, you name it, complex. And it all advocates for war. President Obama said to me in the Roosevelt Room, to my face in the Roosevelt Room in November of 2015, coming to the end of his second term. He said this, quote, "There's a bias in this town toward war," unquote. And then he talked for 30 minutes largely about how he didn't know what to do about it. John Kerry was sitting right beside him. He was absolutely right. It took him 7 years to figure it out. It took Libya. It took Afghanistan. It took dealing with the military for him to figure it out. Well, Eisenhower's worst predictions have come true tenfold. The military-industrial complex dominates national security decision-making. And as he said in 53, this is no way of life at all. It is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. Well, we're hanging from that cross.
Well, but do you think, though, that to be fair to Trump, even though we have a moron in the Oval Office, very few Americans have died on his watch so far. But I guess the concern is that because he's so out of touch, that those around him could manipulate him into situations. So what is it? We've been saying earlier that we're afraid to lose Mattis because he's an adult in the room. But on the other hand, there are these other pressures, and I would suggest that they come from the neoconservatives, to go to war. So just in the last couple of minutes, how do you see this? Because there seems like a push and pull going on here.
It is, and it's almost a desperate coincidence of circumstances. I think if Trump were in a reasonably sound political position with regard to the midterms and himself, that we would have a much greater ability for him to withstand this neoconservative push, which is growing and growing every day. But because he is imperiled, because he might even be thinking that if the House switches, impeachment proceedings will start. If he believes he's in deep peril, then he's apt to fall into the clutches of these neocons who, like Bolton, will convince him that he must do it in order to save his own presidency. That's a very dangerous coincidence.
Well, Lawrence Wilkerson, I appreciate you joining us, and I don't know what to say. I don't think we've ever been in such a dire situation, at least in my recent memory. You've had a long service in both government and the military. How do you see the current situation?
One time have we been this close to really deep, profound peril. I just finished reading Ron Chernow's book on Grant, and it reminded me in exquisite detail of that peril. And that time was 1850 to 1860. And in 1861 to 64, we killed 1 million of our citizens in order to solve it. And we could have fallen apart. We could easily have fallen apart. Had Antietam not been a victory, and had England recognized the South and thrown its weight behind the South, we'd be a two-part nation today, one in the South and one in the North. So we've been here before, but only once. The circumstances are eerily the same.
But we have a president who, rather than try to heal the divisions, is trying to tear the country apart.
Absolutely. Look at Andrew Johnson post-Civil War. When Ulysses Grant, in charge of 1 million battle-tested troops, had to act outside the Constitution because Johnson, once Lincoln was assassinated and Johnson became president, Johnson wanted to restore the South. Remember, he was from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. He wanted to restore the South. He wanted to eradicate what the war had done. Grant looked at that and said, "You're not going to do that, Mr. President." Went out, ordered Sherman and Sheridan and other commanders to go to Charleston, to go to New Orleans and stop the killing of blacks and so forth. And he acted completely outside the Constitution in order to do that. Johnson was almost removed from office by impeachment, missed by a couple of votes. And that tied him up so Grant could do that. But Grant was acting unconstitutionally to do that. We don't want that kind of thing again, but we may be approaching those sorts of happenings again.
Well, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. And currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University.
And in case you're just tuning in, this is Graham Fitzgibbon, producer of Background Briefing, reminding you that Ian Masters is taking a rare day off to recover from a cold. After the break, we're going to revisit an interview from September 10th, when Ian spoke with Richard Clark, who served three consecutive presidents on counterterrorism and cybersecurity issues. He joins us to discuss the probability of Russian cyber meddling in the November election and the danger of having a president who doesn't seem bothered by that possibility and has taken no action to prevent it. We'll be right back with Richard Clark.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Richard Clark, the CEO of Good Harbor Security Risk Management, which advises companies and governments on cybersecurity. He served for 30 years in the U.S. government, including 10 continuous years as a White House official, serving three consecutive presidents as special assistant to the president for global affairs, national coordinator for security and counterterrorism, and special advisor to the president for cyberspace. The author of 8 books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. His most recent book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Prevent Catastrophes. And he is the host of a new podcast, Future State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Clark.
Oh, good to be with you.
And Richard Clark, since you've served in three administrations, both Democratic and Republican, and been a professional on the National Security Council, both in terms of counterterrorism and cybersecurity. If you were in the Trump White House today, would you have written that op-ed piece in the New York Times that's caused so much controversy?
No, I wouldn't. I think two observations. First, it is natural for career civil servants to resist the whims of presidents and to try to slow roll some of their initiatives. That's natural. It's unusual for political appointees to do that. Second observation is there comes a time when you have to quit and go public with your concerns. If you're ordered to do something that's illegal, if you're ordered to do something that's immoral, then I think you have an obligation to quit. But you have to remember that everybody takes an oath before they can serve, and it's an oath not to the president, but to the Constitution. And so when you're being told to do things that would damage the country, I think it's a natural reaction to not do them.
So you mentioned that in terms of setting up this new podcast that you're hosting starting today, Future State, and I take it it's a continuum of the idea that you were a sort of sentinel in your job on the National Security Council to look ahead. And that's why 9/11 was so important in the sense that some people predicted it and others ignored that information. But in saying that we need to be focusing on cyber war, terrorism, nuclear weapons, climate change, and the future of work in America in this election year or these election months, you're suggesting that we shouldn't get lost in the Trump show. just talking about the op-ed, in a sense, in the New York Times is getting lost in the Trump show, in as much as what's happened is with Trump basically conducting what I call government by stunt on a daily basis, the press is not focusing on the contents of that op-ed, but rather on who possibly wrote it.
That's right. And what I'm trying to do with the Future State podcast is not talk about what you're seeing on the cable news, but talk about issues that people should be thinking about and should be discussing. What is the future of work? What is the risk, continuing risk, if there is one, of terrorism? Why are we about to spend $1 trillion on new nuclear weapons? What's the risk of climate change? Those are things that you would normally talk about. You'd look forward at the new risks, the new threats. You'd want candidates to talk about that sort of thing under normal circumstances. And the Trump show drowns all of that out. I'm not saying don't talk about Trump, because we have to. We have to get rid of this guy somehow. So we do have to talk about him. But it shouldn't be the only thing we talk about. We still have to worry about the substance, about the issues.
So what worries me is that we don't know what went on in that secret meeting between Trump and Putin in Helsinki. We certainly saw the aftermath at the press conference, where the president of the United States, in front of the eyes of the world, essentially sided with Putin over whether he meddled in our elections. He, of course, denied it, and Trump basically accepted that denial in front of the cameras, and then later had that kind of lame, you know, my dog ate my homework excuse that I meant to say wouldn't or would have, you know. So we don't know what went on prior to that press conference. The press conference itself was alarming enough. And frankly, I think John Brennan is correct in suggesting that there may have been a line crossed there in terms of treason, because on January the 6th of 2017, a couple of weeks before Trump was inaugurated, all the heads of intelligence briefed him and gave him absolutely unequivocal information about the extent of Russian interference in our elections, and yet he chose to ignore that. Any commander-in-chief in that situation in our history would have turned to Putin and said, yes, you did it, and don't do it again. So let's focus on that for a minute. Do you think this president could be engaged in some kind of treasonous activity short of the traditional legal definition of treason?
Well, I don't know what was said. That's the problem. None of us know what was said. Some people have suggested to me that maybe that was a way of him, a way of Trump getting new orders, getting his orders updated, getting new guidance from the boss. The problem is we don't know. And so rumors like that and assumptions like that are allowed to propagate. And they're terrible rumors and terrible assumptions, but we have no way of knowing whether or not they're true. I think if you look at the Steele dossier, that the British intelligence officer who, during the 2016 election, put together all of this information about Trump and Russia, 99% of that has been corroborated. And that's very disturbing. I think there is something that the Russians have on Trump. I think it probably has to do with money laundering through his company. I'm hoping Bob Mueller will find that and prove it.
Well, but without being paranoid or indulging in conspiracy theories, the fact that that was a secret meeting leads to the, I think, the very real possibility that since Putin interfered in the last election to elect Trump or help elect him, it's not inconceivable that we know that Trump is really paranoid about the Democrats taking the House.
And for good reason.
For good reason, because then they start investigating, which is really what's, I think, the crying shame of what's happening to the United States at the moment, that we don't have a separation of powers, because the legislative branch is not acting as a check and balance on the executive branch, and that will certainly happen if the Democrats take the House. But to my mind, it's not inconceivable that in that private meeting, Trump said, look, you helped me out in 2016, but I really need your help, Vladimir, in November, because this Democratic blue wave is going to probably sweep the Republicans out of the House, and then they'll start investigating me, and they'll impeach me. So
I don't think Trump even has to ask for the Russians' help. I think they know that this situation is occurring, and we know for a fact that many of the troll identities that they were using in 2016 are back. You know, they change. They go on Twitter, and they change the name that they're using. But you can still tell it's the same source. And we know they're active. And they're doing a whole series of things to cause division in our country. They're pretending to be African Americans and saying blacks should not vote. They're pretending to be environmentalists. And they're saying people should vote for the Green Party. It's not a wasted vote, you know, even though it obviously is. They're assuming all sorts of different identities, not just to promote Republicans, not just to promote Trump and his allies, but also just to whip up hate and dissension here in the United States.
Well, but you also could be describing Fox News in a sense, because the Russians call them political technologists. But this character, Surkov, a theater director who became Putin's media advisor and has basically created this alternative universe where facts don't matter, that nothing is true and everything is possible, that's sort of migrated here to the United States. And if 30% of the country wasn't locked inside the bubble of delusion that Fox and Breitbart and Sinclair propagate, Trump would, I think that would be, he'd be on his way out totally, as opposed to hanging on and pandering to that constituency. So do you see any similarities there in this Orwellian sense that we have, you know, when you got people like Kellyanne Conway, the White House counsel, talking about alternative facts?
You see these themes pop up, and they're picked up by Fox News. They're picked up by Breitbart. They're also picked up by the Russian outlets like RT and Sputnik. And they're picked up by all the Russian troll identities. And it's difficult to know from one theme to another where they first appeared, because they have a remarkable tendency to appear simultaneously, it seems, on both the Russian outlets, the Russian trolls and fake identities, and Fox News and Breitbart all at the same time.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Clark, CEO of Good Harbor Security Risk Management, which advises companies and governments on cybersecurity. He served for 30 years in the United States government, including 10 continuous years as a White House official, serving 3 consecutive presidents, a special assistant to the president for global affairs, national coordinator for security and counterterrorism, and special advisor to the president for cyberspace. The author of 8 books, including the New York Times number 1 bestseller, Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. His most recent book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Prevent Catastrophes. And he's the host of the new podcast, Future State. But in your previous job, after you was head of counterintelligence on the National Security Council, Richard Clark, you became the cyber czar, for the want of a better description. Back to that question, though, we don't know what went on in that secret meeting in Helsinki between Putin and Trump, but we do know that the Russians made explorations in the last election cycle in 2016 into voting rolls and into state election systems, many of which aren't secure at all, particularly in Georgia, where you have a Secretary of State who himself doesn't appear to believe in democracy and is quite capable of rigging the results on these electronic machines, which he did in terms of the John Ossoff race down there in that first important special election that could have been a bellwether for Trump's support. What's your understanding of how vulnerable we are to either election rolls being hacked or the results themselves in this midterm being hacked?
Well, you have 3 different things that can be hacked. You have the campaign organizations themselves. Some of them are independent, some of them are party organizations, but they're notoriously vulnerable because they just don't have enough money for cybersecurity. It turns out really securing a network is expensive. The second thing you have that can be hacked are the voting rolls, so that when someone shows up to vote, they're not on the list, or they're They have to go to another location. And many of those people will just say, the hell with it at that point. Or it'll make the lines very long in certain locations. If you know the Democrats are going to do well in that precinct, you make the lines very long there, and people will eventually go home if they're having to stand out in the rain. The third thing that you can hack, of course, are the machines themselves, and that turns out to be notoriously easy if you have access. Now, getting the access is difficult, but there are three different things. And what we've learned is the Russians have tried to do hacking into campaigns, succeeded in the case of the Clintons. They've tried to hack into the voting lists. We don't know that they've tried to go after the machines, but here's the thing that I would point out. We don't know the extent of what they've done. We only know what people have caught. And most of the time when a Russian state organization tries to hack into something, they do it so well that they don't get caught. So when people say, oh, there's no evidence that this happened, yeah, well, of course not. There wouldn't be evidence because they're really good at it. When the United States government does it, there's no evidence.
And in terms of terrorism, though, I would link it in a way to going back to Putin. I don't mean to obsess on him, and I get lots of letters from listeners saying that I'm obsessed with Russia, but I don't believe there's ever been anything like this. The very possibility that the President of the United States could be an asset of the leader in the Kremlin is the most extraordinary, if it's true, it'd be the most extraordinary intelligence operation since the Germans put Lenin in a boxcar in 1917 and sent him to Russia. So that's my justification for keeping an eye on Putin. But I see a link here in terms of what's happening in Western Europe, where one or two terrorist acts can change elections, as we've just seen in Sweden. Last time when Putin intervened in Syria, shortly thereafter was the major exodus of refugees into Europe. Now they have Idlib surrounded and they're about to pound that place into submission. 3 million refugees could flood into Turkey and on into Europe. And last time it happened, the SACEUR, the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, referred to what Putin was doing as was weaponizing refugees. So that seems to me to be a strategy that he's used and he may use again to weaken Western Europe. What's our strategy?
Well, we don't have one. The United States is not a player in what's going on in Turkey, in Syria. You know, we still have 2,000 troops in and around Syria. But if you look at the last two diplomatic conferences, summits, the president of Russia, the president of Turkey, the president of Iran, they're the ones who are sitting around the table deciding what's going to happen. There's no American at that table.
So how are we going to get through then this period where you have this almost theater of the absurd with President Trump? He's swapping kind of love letters via tweet with Kim Jong-un. He had this absolutely fatuous and meaningless photo op down in Singapore. It's obvious that it's going nowhere. He wants to meet with Putin. None of the real stuff's being dealt with. Where are these so-called adults in the room? Are they just not in a position that we've never had a situation before where we have a president who himself is very likely to be a threat to America's national security?
This reminds me of the period when Richard Nixon was on the ropes, the last days of Richard Nixon, when he was hitting the bottle, his alcoholism was rampant. And his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, and the Secretary of Defense, Jim Schlesinger, were running the national security show, including the Middle East war that was going on in 1973, essentially without talking to the president, because they were afraid to. I don't think we've had anything like it in my lifetime except for that. It's almost the Manchurian Candidate, if you saw the original movie, where the leader could, in fact, be under control, could be a controlled asset of a foreign government. I don't know that that's true, but I think it's a reasonable suspicion, and that's pretty awful.
Well, just in closing, I don't want to depress our audience. I certainly, myself, on a daily basis, I feel I'm dispensing the daily dose of doom, just covering Donald Trump. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, I think there is. I felt very, watching the John McCain memorial at National Cathedral, I felt uplifted. That the church was filled with great Americans, all of whom want to have nothing to do with Donald Trump. And people talked about what this country has been, what this country is, what this country can be again. I think this could be a passing disaster, like a hurricane going through a city. I hope that's the case. But for that to be the case, people have to get out and vote in November.
Well, on that note, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Richard Clark.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Richard Clark, CEO of Good Harbor Security Risk Management, which advises companies and governments on cybersecurity. He served for 30 years in the United States government, including 10 continuous years as a White House official, serving three consecutive presidents as Special Assistant to the President for Global Affairs, National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism, and Special Advisor to the President for Cyberspace. The author of 8 books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. His most recent book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Prevent Catastrophes. And he is the host of the new podcast, Future State.
Again, this is Graham Fitzgibbon, producer of Background Briefing, here to remind you that Ian Masters is feeling a little under the weather today and is taking a rare day off to recover. He'll be back on the air here tomorrow at 5 p.m. But for now, we thought we might take this opportunity to revisit a few recent interviews worthy of more attention. After the break, we have Rob Reyers and Doug Paget, two evangelical pastors who have broken with Christian fundamentalism and are now campaigning against the elite evangelicals who are the enablers of President Trump and the Republicans under the banner of a new organization, Vote Common Good. We'll be right back after the break with more of Background Briefing.
When the president talks to God, do they drink near beer and go play golf? While they pick which countries to invade, which Muslim souls still can be saved? I guess God just calls a spade when the president talks to God. When the president talks to God, does he ever think that maybe he's not? That voice is just inside his head.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Rob Reyers, who is the political director of Vote Common Good and the founding pastor of Vintage Fellowship in Fayetteville, Arkansas. In 2018, Rob was the first Republican candidate endorsed by Brand New Congress and challenged Representative Steve Womack in the primary. He is the author of Fundamorphosis, How I Left Fundamentalism But Didn't Lose My Faith. And Doug Paget is the executive director and co-founder of Vote Common Good, a radio host, pastor, and author. He founded Solomon's Porch in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as one of the leading emerging culture churches in the country. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rob Reyers and Doug Paget.
Thank you, Ian.
So let me begin with Rob and the meeting that took place in the White House 2 days after John McCain died. Evangelical pastors were warned by Donald Trump if they didn't rally their faithful to turn out and vote Republicans, Democrats, quote, will overturn everything that we've done and they'll do it quickly and violently. And that, of course, upset a lot of people in this country because no political leader, whether he's president or leader of a party, has ever actually suggested that another party would indulge in political violence. How did it strike you?
Well, it strikes me as pandering to the lowest common denominator and fear-mongering, which, you know, in my faith tradition, whenever people act out of fear rather than faith, they typically end up making the wrong decisions. And so I think to appeal to a group of pastors and religious leaders and try to stoke fear in them in hopes that they'll take that fear back to their congregations is both unproductive, I think, you know, for churches, but also, for our political discourse as a country. But, you know, it is kind of par for the course what we've seen with this administration and its partnership with most of evangelicals in our country.
And Doug Padgett, Vote for Common Good is an intentional effort to dislodge control of Congress from the Republican Party by inspiring Christians to vote on November 6, 2018, according to what their faith tells us is the common good. So the idea that the religious right dominates our politics, particularly the Republican Party, where do you see yourself? Are you tilting at windmills or are you fighting the good fight?
Yeah, that's a great question. We ask that question every day in this campaign. You know, we're doing what religious people have done for millennia, and that is hit the road to go down the street, to go find our neighbors and friends, and to encourage them to do the thing that they know is the good and right thing. And there's a lot of people in this country who know what good is, and a lot of people who are in religious traditions believe in the good news. And so they know that believing in the good news means they have to care about the common good for all people. And we don't need to tell them what good is. They know what it is, and they can sense that this Trump takeover of the Republican Party is really no good. And that's something that we're not on a campaign to try to convince people to do something they don't want to do. We're hoping that what we're going to do is to encourage people to do that thing that they know is the right and good thing to do. And what they need is a community and a champion to join with them and some other people to encourage them to do that thing on November 6th that they felt like is the right thing to do. And for a lot of Republican voters who are religious, to not vote for a Republican is a really big thing. And so we're not asking people to become Democrats. We're asking them to vote in a way that feels like it's right with their conscience and right with their faith.
And you're going to be touring from December the 29th to November the 4th across the country, visiting 31 crucial congressional districts in 15 states. Now, Let me run by Rob Ryerse the manifesto, if you will. You're asking the faithful to take action. One, we'll vote in the 2018 midterm elections. Two, we'll vote with the poor, vulnerable, and forgotten in mind. We'll vote with peace and safety in mind. We'll vote with God's creation, the planet, in mind. We will vote against policies and politicians who promise special privileges for any religion, including our own. And we'll vote for politicians who support laws against the corrupting influence of corporate and special interest group donations on our political system. So is that resonating? It certainly resonates with me. Rob?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what's interesting is that so often when people go to vote, they are thinking about their own self-interest and the interests of their families. They're thinking about what politician is going to enact policies that will be good for my wallet and my bank account, my 401k. And that is understandable. But our faith calls us to have a view that is bigger than ourselves, to recognize that, you know, when we love our neighbor, how we vote is included in that. And so what we're trying to do is broaden people's vision so that they can recognize that, you know, is an act of faith, is an act of love, is an act of peacemaking in our world and in our communities. I need to think not just about how do these policies impact me personally, but how do they impact everybody else? And that's why it's not just vote good, it's vote for the common good. There's something about how we need to look out for each other. And so, you know, what we're challenging is kind of that selfish approach to voting, that frankly is, you know, really taken hold in a lot of evangelical Republican voters, and asking them to think about, hey, listen, you know, how you vote impacts not just your family, but it impacts your neighbor as well. It impacts your community. And these commitments that we've made and that we're asking our leaders to make and voters to make are about extending love and grace and peace and justice in a much broader way.
Well, Doug, one of the things that I find extraordinary is that the evangelicals, particularly the televangelists, it's almost as though there are no other books in the Bible but the book of Revelation. And the Beatitudes just don't even – they're not even on the horizon. And I've often sort of said on this radio program, sort of rhetorically, you know, puzzled in a way, saying, well, as far as I recall, the prophet Jesus didn't have an assault rifle, didn't hate gays, didn't celebrate capital punishment, and didn't fly around in a Gulfstream jet shaking down poor people for money. You two and your organization, Vote Common Good, have in your manifesto said that you've added to what my puzzlement is. You added that by saying Jesus would not separate children from parents, Jesus would not turn his back on the poor, and Jesus would not neglect the sick. Again, that's a powerful message, and I think surely that should resonate with Christians.
I hope it will, and I will grant that for a lot of people who hold to those positions and those policy positions and that way of being, they haven't often in the political arena connected that with their faith or with their deeply held belief in the teachings of Jesus. There are a lot of politicians who hold very deep faith personally, and they don't talk about it in the public arena. And there's an awful lot of Republican politicians who I don't think really honor the teachings of Jesus all that closely in their policies, but they sure are quick to want to quote the Bible or to act as if their policies are matching up with a Christian teaching. So in a lot of ways, part of what we're wanting to do with Vote Common Good is not only to encourage the voter to think differently, but we also want to encourage the Democratic politicians or the independent politicians or the Green Party politicians to consider the ways and the teachings of not only the Christian faith, but of other faiths, and to allow that to influence their policymaking. There's been a really unfortunate habit of asking religious people to leave their deeply held spiritual and faith tradition at the political door for progressives. And that's something that we hope Vote Common Good wants to be an alternative and a remedy for, allowing people to pull those pieces of their faith and the pieces of their political aspirations more deeply together, because they don't need to be in violation with one another at all. It's a little hard to read the Sermon on the Mount or any of the teachings of Jesus and to correspond that with the Republican agenda for the world or for the United States. And we think that's totally worth pointing out to people.
Well, Rob Ricey and Doug Padgett, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate you joining us very much, and we'll revisit you later in the election cycle to see how things are going.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Rob Ricey, who's the political director of Vote for Common Good and the founding pastor of Vintage Fellowship in Fayetteville, Arkansas. In 2018, Rob was the first Republican candidate endorsed by brand new Congress and challenged Representative Steve Womack in the primary. He's the author of Fundamorphosis, How I Left Fundamentalism But Didn't Lose My Faith. And Doug Padgett is executive director and co-founder of Vote Common Good, a radio host, pastor, and author. He founded Solomon's Porch in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as one of the leading emerging culture churches in the country.
Again, this is Graham Fitzgibbon, producer of Background Briefing. Been sitting in for Ian Masters here today to compile some recent interviews we thought deserving of more attention. Big thanks to Ricky Herrera, helping out on the board today. Ian Masters will be back on the air here tomorrow, live at 5 p.m., with another Background Briefing. This show is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for podcasts and follow us on social media. Till next time.